Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to today's show on World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. I'm your host, Paul John Roach, and the Bhagavad Gita is one of the greatest and most significant spiritual texts of India and known throughout the whole world, and it's been translated numerous times. I've got several copies myself, and hundreds of commentaries have been written about it. Today, though, I welcome the author of a translation that was 12 years in the making and one that is distinguished by its metrical pattern and rhyme. So I'm going to find out more about that in a second. Isaac Bentwich, MD, lives in Israel. He's a longtime practitioner and teacher of yoga and meditation. He's also a medical doctor and scientist who has been involved in and founded three life science technology companies specializing in genomics and environmental conservation. His work is highly regarded and has been published in top-tier scientific and other publications. Dr. Bentwich marries his scientific research and innovative approach with silent meditation in the Galilee and in the foothills of the Himalayas. So sounds like a fascinating man, fascinating subject. It's going to be a fascinating show. So it's a joy to welcome Isaac Bentwich to today's show all the way from Israel. So welcome. We're glad you're with us.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for the introduction.
So what part of Israel do you live in, Isaac?
I currently live in the northern part of Israel, just south of Haifa, and not far from the Galilee.
Right, yeah, excellent. You know, you mentioned in the book that when you first came across the Gita, I think you were at some kind of yoga training, and you kind of scoffed at it a little bit. You were into the yoga, Hatha yoga aspects, but not, yeah, maybe not the philosophy. And of course, you were grounded in your own religion, you know, in Judaism. But of course, that changed, doesn't it? You went from scoffing at it to be amazed by it, and now, you know, doing this translation.
Yes, I admit that the first time I came across the Gita in this 30-day intensive course in the desert, it was the only thing that I really hated. sounds funny to but you know, I was into the physical postures. I was teaching yoga to make ends meet, and it was something that I enjoyed, and so came to the course primarily to improve my teaching skills, and hearing that there's some meditation and some philosophy, I thought that that'd be nice, that'd be fine. Little did I know that the Gita will become a great love of my life, and something that becomes enmeshed in my life, and which I'm passionate sharing with others.
Yes, very good. I have a similar story, because I was in Calcutta in 1976, and I was waiting in line to buy some tickets, you know, which you had to do in those days. It took a long time to get train tickets or whatever. And somebody handed me a copy of the Gita. It was the Juan Mascaro version, which is a great one, actually.
Yeah.
And But I was the same. It wasn't time, you know. I looked at it and I thought, no, Lord, this is just too much, and put it away for a while. But then when I came back to it, of course, it became one of the most important texts for me, you know, in my life. And I was teaching it a few years later, you know, in seminary, when I went to seminary. And, you know, I think that's true about the Gita, isn't it? It's a very profound text, you know. And then unless you're ready for it, it's not going to speak to you. But when you are, it's sort of, oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Another thing, and you mentioned this in the book, I think, is that it's very dense, isn't it? It's only 700 verses. But it's the sort of text you can read forever and never exhaust it. You know, it's a deep scripture.
Yes, and yet, you know, one of the things that I'm sure you will identify with this as well, we say it's dense, but it's dense and light at the same time. Mm-hmm. You often have these scriptures that are very condensed, but you really have to wreck your brain around it in order to chisel your way through. And this is really more like water flowing. I don't know if you know this, but the 700 verses of the Gita have been likened by some of the commentators to a string of 700 smooth pearls. And they say that each such a pearl of wisdom, each verse is a pearl of wisdom that stands on its own right, and yet it is connected subtly to the pearl before and the pearl after it. And I find this picture very accurate, because the way that these verses really roll around in your mind, it's more rolling pearls than it is chiseling rock, is what I'm saying.
Yes, interesting. Yeah. Well, and you can approach it intellectually, you know, you can read it and sort of get the gist of it. Oh, yeah, I think I understand that. But that's really only a superficial level, isn't it? You know, you really have to experience the deep intuitive understanding of it and the beauty of it. Like you said, the pearls, you know, and their luster and everything. It's not to be grasped just by the head, but by the heart.
Exactly, which is what led me to this I don't know, long love affair that I'm having with this scripture, to be attracted and then to be immersed in the poetic side of things. I think in me there is both the intellectual side from my father and the intuitive poetic side from my late mother. As years went by, I'm drifting more towards the poetic. When I first met the Gita, and I think that many translations, you get this impression of a text that is important. And it's really interesting that the name of this book is Bhagavad Gita, literally meaning the song of God. So, you know, it's really, especially in our generation and time, which is so intellectual and objective focused, the song of God, not the lecture of God, not the text of God, not the book of God, the song of God, because it is only through a song and other intuitive modes that over intellectualization may be subdued and that facilitates going beyond thoughts and intellect and into listening mode, actually listening to the inner voice of your soul, which is what the Gita is about, of course.
Right, very beautifully put, thank you. And for those who aren't familiar, it's like we said, it's a short text. It was originally part of the Mahabharata, the great epic of India, and you can find it in there, but it stands alone, and it picks up some of the themes that you'll find in the Mahabharata, but it really, the basic idea is this battle, isn't it? There's this difficulty of how do I act? How do I act wisely? In the right way, you know, when I'm confronted by violence, when I'm actually aware that I'm going to be, you know, probably slaughtering other human beings and maybe even relatives of my own. So this is the presenting conundrum, if you like. How do we act in a beautiful way in a violent world, in this physical world of duality. Go ahead. I think we may have lost Dr. Bentwich, but while we're waiting for him to come back, I just wanted to tell those that aren't familiar with the book. Like we said, it's a scripture that stands on its own. You can read it, in a short amount of time, but then you can take a whole lifetime to really understand it. It's influenced people as diverse as Emerson, Beethoven, Leonard Cohen, Goethe, Carl Jung. Famously, Robert Oppenheimer quoted it after the exploding of the first atom bomb, because he was a deep student of the Gita and quoted one of the passages from it. In the modern day, we've got Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra and others who have found great meaning in the Gita, and of course, Mahatma Gandhi as well. Is Dr. Bentwich back?
Yes.
Good. I was just filling them in on some of the eminent people who were influenced by the Gita. But we were talking about the opening premise, and you had a comment to make.
Yes, the as you described the picture there is that of a battle and in a battlefield centuries ago and continents away, and I think that my comment is that this is part of the thing that some people, in myself included, find difficult in relating to the Gita, and you sort of need to get over it and see it for what it is, a metaphor for the struggles in our lives. And these are not the life and death bloody battles. Rather, the strife, the struggle of life itself, in relationships, in parenting, in career, in spirituality, in balancing career and spirituality. It is this a battle of strife of life that has us so easily identifying with the prince, with his bloody battle ahead. And the second point I'd make is that the whole theme of the Gita is internalizing our viewpoint. We tend to look at these battles, these difficulties in life, as an external battle. And the whole alchemy, if you will, of the Gita and of all spiritual paths is to see the real battle is internal and not external, and it is our attitude and motivation which really matter.
Right, absolutely. And the two great protagonists in the Gita, of course, are Arjuna, right, who is like you said, the prince who has the problem, the initial problem, how am I to act? And who represents every man, if you like. If you think of him as us, he's us.
Yeah.
And then you have this image of Krishna, who in India, of course, is a god. And so that person represents the divine in us, if you like, who's the guide to Arjuna, the everyman. So the dialogue that goes on between these two, and there's a few other characters, but that's the main dialogue, is between our humanness and our divine self, if you like. And so it's a very intimate portrait, isn't it? That's the beauty of the Gita. We're an intimate connection to our own divinity here, who's actually willing to explain everything to us, in a very loving but strong strong way. And has our own best interests at heart, but isn't going to pull any punches here. It's going to tell us exactly, what's going on.
Yeah. And the thing is that this divine voice here of Krishna, this is why I elected in this translation. I tried over the years of working on it to carefully, gently, as responsibly as I can, to peel the layers of mythology and terminology, and leave it as it is in its essence, and as all of the great commentators describe, a dialogue with the inner voice of wisdom within. This is not a dialogue with some wrathful god, whether you call him Jehovah or Christ or Krishna. It is really an inner dialogue, as you described, with the the inner voice of our soul, which when we go beyond noisy thoughts and emotions, we sort of hear from within.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, Arjuna is very desolate at the beginning, isn't he? He's almost loses. He's supposed to be a great prince. He's supposed to embody all the qualities of a great warrior, you know, and the courage and fortitude and all this. And he's the opposite of that. He's become a kind of a wimp here. And Krishna tells him, you know, this is not fitting for you. You know, this is no way to live. And, you know, I think we've all been in those times where we've got a little pity party going on. You know, life is terrible. Ain't it awful? There's no point me going on. You know, this is useless. This is hopeless. And we get that wake up call, you know, to remind us, hey, listen, you that is not who you are. You know, you are something greater, right? You have the divine within you. And you also must do your duty. And this is a huge thing, isn't it? The idea of dharma, it's much more than the word duty. It's sort of right. I think that Jesus might use the word righteousness. What is the rightful thing to do at any given time?
Yeah. I eventually translated it as calling because, you know, it's a duty, but it is one which is natural to us and which we get fulfilled by following. And so it's a duty or calling. But you know that the first few verses there that you just described of the despondency of the prince and the anticlimactic answer of the master, which are sort of shocking before he goes on to describe the instructions of how to live wisely. Can I read a couple of verses?
Yes, here? Please.
So the prince says, after a long discourse, exactly like you said, standing on his stump and preaching to God about why the situation is impossible and the righteousness, etc. And then finally, in a moment of grace, he breaks down and says, I don't know. And it is then that wisdom flows. After this long speech, the prince says, a veil of pity routs my heart. Mine's dark. Where does my duty lay? We spoke of duty. Guide me, master. What ought I do? I'm your disciple. Show me the way. And then thus spoke the brave warrior prince, conqueror of sleep, master of will. I shall not fight, he added, and then spoke no more and was still. Then to him, between the two armies, disconsolate by these tormenting trials, the master, ruler of senses, spoke, wearing the faintest of smiles. And you can almost see this Buddha-like faint smile on the teacher's, on the master's lips. What are you smiling? My life is in shambles. I need an answer. This or that? Yes or no? Black or white? Tell me what to do. What are you smiling? And the master pulls the rug under all of this, all of our folly, with the basic assumptions and the master says, you speak words of wisdom, O prince, but your sorrow is in vain. For the truly wise never mourn, neither the living nor the slain. There was never a time we were not, me or you or these enemy kings, nor can there be any future in which we ever cease being. And so on and so forth. But you hear the music and how these pearls of wisdom roll in your mind and do their thing. You're not the body. You're not the mind. You've got it all wrong. You are the spirit wearing the body as cloth. We'll get down to in instructions as you were asking, Prince, of what to do next. But please, let's first understand the basic principle. You are not the body or mind. So I'm always moved by these verses and by the melodiousness that they have.
All right, absolutely. Another beautiful thing about it is, you know, it doesn't short circuit anything, does it? It doesn't say, don't think those things. You know, he said you've spoken wisely from the level that you're coming from, but you know, I'm going to show you another level. And so that's beautiful too, because you know, some teachings tell you to be a certain way, or they hector you, or they have commandments or whatever. This isn't. This is much wiser. It's you know, it's a deeper and more subtle psychology, I think, that allows for all aspects of our being, right? But you know, but the main image is that, yeah, you know, the spirit within you was never born, it's never died. Yeah. You know, that is your reality, right? So that's what you should hold fast to. And then, like you said, he presents ways then throughout the rest of the book of doing just that, right? Of understanding that. You know, there's three key ways to approach it, isn't there? Through what they call karma yoga or action,
yes.
Through bhakti yoga, which is devotion, or through jnana yoga, which is the yoga of wisdom. And all three are presented, right, in the Gita. And they're often intermixed together, aren't they?
Yes. That's exactly right. And these three paths, they're called three margas, the three paths, the path of action, the path of devotion, or we could say the path of the heart, and the path of wisdom, ultimately, are both rungs of on a ladder, and a complementary path which we all act in our lives. And it's really nice how these are laid out, and that's one of the things that's so unique about the Gita. Many wisdom scriptures and religion paths focus on one. They either give the how to live in the world, or they act through intuition or mysticism or belief and faith and the incredible power of faith, or their jnana yoga, their the harsh, unrelenting question of seeking an answer to the question of who am I and what the world is like. And here you have these intertwined and one leading to the other. It begins with how do you act in the world? How can we learn the act of the art, really, of living wisely, such that every day does not make us more hunched and scorched by life, but is a stepping stone of becoming wiser, and which is a wonderful theme that I think we can all relate to. And then this leads to the next path, the path of devotion, which really encourages us to the, like you mentioned earlier, the opposite of retreating. Open your eyes, says the Gita. Hear the laughter of children. Look at the sunset. See the birds. See the flowers. See the beautiful things, the ugly things. I am all that. This is all unity. It is all consciousness. It is all God. And by seeing the unity outside, we gradually are encouraged to perceive ourselves as part of that unity. And then finally, the path of wisdom, which is the peak of this spiritual Everest, if you will. Who am I? At the end of it all, who am I? I am a drop in an ocean where the drop is no more. I'm a wave in an ocean which realizes that I'm ocean itself, life itself, consciousness itself, God itself.
And, you know, the key to doing all that, and when the Gita speaks to this all the way through, is renunciation, right? I'm giving up my identification with my body, mind, and instead I'm holding fast to the truth of my being. And I can't do that unless I can see that everything is me, and I'm part of everything, right? As long as I have a personal sense of self, then I'm lost. I'm lost in that, right? And so the Gita advises us to renounce that. You know, it's not that I have to give up my family or give up my possessions, but I'm no longer attached to them. I don't see them as the ultimate reality. They are just an expression of the one, and in that renunciation, you know, is freedom. I think in the West, you know, the word renunciation sounds old-fashioned, sounds harsh. You know, I don't.
Yes.
We're an acquisitive society. It's like, I don't want to renounce everything. I deserve to have it all. You know, the gospel of prosperity or whatever.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you can have it all, can't you? When you can never have it all when you're only a part of something. When you're the whole of something, when you recognize who you are, then the whole universe flows through you. So that's
exactly.
the ultimate opulence, if you like, you know.
Yeah, And exactly speaking to that, here are two verses which I so connected so strongly with. I used to carry them in my purse for several years. And they speak exactly to what you're saying, because, you know, the challenge is, okay, I'm not this body. How do I do that? What do I do to other than intellectually understanding that? And so right. Here are two verses that speak to this, and they say, I do nothing at all, the wise never forgets, heart united with the divine, enlightened soul. Whether grasping, moving, sleeping, or breathing, whatever is heard, or what the eyes behold, eyes open or shut, whatever seen or heard, silently, without words, the wise always knows. I do not see any sight. I do not hear. 'Tis the senses that see and hear all those. And so it's this poetic beauty that says what you just described. Don't avoid joys and pleasures, or don't close your eyes, but realize, in the tantric path, this is how pleasures, intense pleasures, are leveraged to go beyond pleasure. And so it is this, open your eyes and see the world and enjoy everything that it has to offer, but use it as a tools to realize that it is life living through you, God living through you.
Right, very good. Folks, I'm with Isaac Bentwich, MD. He's just written a book, a translation of the Gita, and it's in verse form and with rhymes, as you may hear in some of the readings here. It's wonderful. And another contribution to our understanding of this great text. We're at the break. Let's take a couple of minutes to listen to these messages from Unity, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about the Gita, the fascinating book, the Gita. And I hope this inspires you to pick up a copy and have a look for yourself. Even if you've read it many times, this new translation, I think, is going to edify you again. All right, join us in a couple of minutes.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
It takes you to power Unity Online Radio. If you'd like to make a positive difference in the world, you can by contributing to this global ministry. Unity Online Radio relies on listeners like you to support our broadcasts that send our messages out to an awakening world. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate today.
Here's a Unity Wisdom moment with Iyanla Van Zandt, taken from a Celebrate Your Life event in Phoenix, Arizona.
The universe is not going to wait for you. And if you keep talking yourself out of what you're told to do because of your negative self-talk or the crazy you inherited, somebody else is going to pick up on the idea. How many times have you been told to do something and you start figuring out the how? But the philosopher Nietzsche told us, if you've got a strong enough what, the how will be provided. The way you do the things that the universe is calling you to do is don't ask how. When you get the instruction, just start moving. Everything else will show up for you.
To find a Celebrate Your Life event near you, visit celebrateyourlife.com.
Time is running out on the early bird discount to travel with Unity to Rome and the Amalfi Coast next spring. You'll tour the countryside with guides to the history, the food, the Vatican, and of course the Sistine Chapel. Explore charming villages and maybe enjoy some Italian wine. Space is limited for the tour group and it's filling fast. Register by September 15th for the discount. Go to unity.org/Rome2020.
Hi, this is Lisa Williams. I'm launching a brand new online course called Enhance Your Intuition, unlocking the power of your spiritual senses. Join me for this transformational experience where you'll learn how to engage, enhance, and embrace your intuition on a whole new level. Plus, save 10% with the coupon code UNITY. Visit lisawilliams.com/intuition and register today.
Do you dread going to work every day and just pray for Friday? Get a fresh perspective on your career with Mo Fall and Bring Your Soul to Work every Thursday at 11 a.m. Central, 12 p.m. Eastern, here on unityonlineradio.org. A leadership mentor and career coach, Mo can help you go from underpaid, unsatisfied, and unappreciated to loving your life and career again. Join the show and let Mo guide you to make some real life changes. Tune in every Thursday here on unityonlineradio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
Okay, so welcome back to today's show. This is World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. I'm your host, Paul John Roach, and I'm with Isaac Bentwich, MD. He's coming to us all the way from Israel, which is an honor for us. And he's talking about his new book. It's called Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. And it's a modern translation in verse form. And we've been discussing some of the key and amazing themes of the Gita, themes that really will set us free if we pay attention to them. Because this is a path of transformation and freedom. And we've been talking about the various ways we can approach the divine, you know, through action, through devotion, through wisdom, and through renunciation, the idea that we're releasing our grasp on the illusion that we think we are, and welcoming with open arms the truth of who we are. And, you know, when you're in that place, there's always a smile. And you know, we mentioned earlier that Arjuna had a smile on his face. Well, I think when you realize who you are in truth, you often burst out laughing, actually, because you realize, oh, my goodness, I've been foolishly thinking life was so, you know, one way, and it's totally the other way. And it's good news, because we are free. We're always free. We've never lost this truth. We're the fish in the water looking for the water. And yes. The Gita helps us to realize that we are always in the water. You know, I love the chapter. I think it's chapter 9, which is you know, the divine glories of God, because it says of all the best things, this, you know, I am this and that.
Yes.
And it's just glorious poetry, like you mentioned. But then in the very next chapter, you know, I think Arjuna is feeling pretty, you know, together right by now. He thinks he's got it. You know, I got a handle on this. So he says, okay, God, I'm ready for you to move from your, you know, your human form, your the way you're showing up here, to your true form, you know, your cosmic glory. And so, you know, would you do that? And initially, I think Krishna's, you know, I'm not sure you're ready for this, but you know, Arjuna insists, and so we get this amazing chapter, don't we? It's a vision of the whole universe, you know, and it's as if 1,000 suns were shining at once, and we get all these images of life and death and whatnot, the extreme power.
And the 1,000 suns shining at once are, of course, reminiscent of Oppenheimer quoting a verse also from this chapter. Now I am become death. And the 1,000 suns, when he saw the blast of the atomic bomb, and then it's striking to know that Oppenheimer and other physicists of quantum physics had a deep appreciation for the Gita and for the Vedanta non-dual philosophy that it represents. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And in fact, got a lot of inspiration from it in terms of, you know, working on their own profound understanding, you know, of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, because, you know, quantum physics seems to mirror in many ways, doesn't it? This non-duality and then the field and all that, you know, there's stuff that we're still looking at today in terms of marrying science and spirituality together, which is quite fascinating. You know, I've always loved Alice in Wonderland, you know, by Lewis Carroll, who was a great mathematician, of course.
Yeah.
And so many of his ideas, you know, were sort of quantum ideas and mixed with humor and certain spirituality. And, you know, it's like, I love that idea that it's all mixed up together. It's not discrete. It's not like, well, there's science on the one hand and then there's mysticism on the other. No, we're finding that, you know, it's the same, right? It's blended together in God's universe. There is only one. So this is quite fascinating, and you're an exemplar of that, I guess, really, because you know you're a scientist yourself, a doctor, whatnot, and yet you're also, you know, deeply involved with this awareness. So bringing those two things together. Very few of us can bear a vision of the cosmic glories, though, can we? It's way too frightening, right? We can I think it was T.S. Eliot said, humankind cannot bear too much reality. And I think, you know, that's probably true. We can only take it in bite-sized pieces, otherwise we're going to explode.
No, it's also interesting, you know, after this chapter 10, which you mentioned previously, that gives this cosmic, a God appearing everywhere. There's a long catalogue of I'm this and I'm that, I'm the wetness in the water and I'm the air in the sky and so forth. And then the very last verse of this chapter 10, before he goes into this terrible vision, he says, all that is glorious in this world, mighty, wondrous, splendid of sight, know that all these emanate from a trifling morsel of my might. But then he says, mm-hmm. but tell me, O prince, why need you know all of these details so fine? Suffice it, you know I exist, the whole world upheld by a fragment of mine. And this is so beautiful, not only because of the theory of saying, you know, it's everything in the world, the God or consciousness contains everything and all of the divisions are apparent. It's also a subtle instruction for us to, speaking of renunciation, to renounce our inquisitive mind. More and more, I want to know this, I want to understand this, another fact, and another tree. Forget it, says the Gita. Just take a look at the forest. The trees are less important, which I find really uplifting.
You know, another teaching in that scripture that you just read, too, is the idea that, you know, the Gita talks about I am in everything, but I am not of everything. You know, I am not. It's not like a pantheistic idea where God is everything. So once I understand that, I understand God. No, God is in it, but not of it. And just a tiny bit of God fills everything. You know, God is more magnificent, in other words, than even the magnificence of the universe. And that's not to downplay the universe. It's to say there is always more. You know, I'm always concerned about people that they say, oh, well, I don't have to fear God. That's Old Testament, you know, that's the Hebrew Bible. And I think, wait a minute now. You know, unless you fear God, you know, you have no appreciation of God. It's not fear like in a negative sense of fearing things. It's awestruck, you know. There has to be that awestruck quality that, you know, that the divine is greater, you know, than anything we can conceive of as human beings. You know, even in our most exalted states, there's still got to be that humility, I think, you know, not get lost, like you said, in thinking we can, if we acquire enough or inquire enough, we're going to find the answer. And, you know, that's probably not going to happen. There has to be a degree of I don't know, right? Of letting go, right? Letting it happen, letting it be, because that's true creativity.
And you know, everything you say compels me to, or attracts me to read a few verses and the things that you just touched upon. I think the Gita has this wonderful extreme opposites that often appear together. On the one hand, these examples of exalted being and exalted state of mind, which we are beckoned to follow and are at awe that this can be. Can it really be that somebody can be like that? Is it really possible? The same awe that Christ has upon us. Wow, is it really possible to even strive for that? And at the same time, this loving and down-to-earth approach that speaks at eye level to me and you, not to these saints and sages. So here are a few verses. Then does such purified heart know bliss that's beyond what senses can, established in this reality, never to wander again. Having obtained it, one now knows this treasure is superior to all. Knowledge so certain cannot be shaken, though greatest of sorrows befall. And then this is on the one side, and then at the other, and speaking of renunciation, it goes on to say, utterly abandoned. How do you get to that state? Utterly abandoned desires, Prince. This is the renunciation. Get rid of the desires, not of the desired objects. Utterly abandoned desires, Prince. No, they all arise from your thought. The wild pack of senses restrain, discerning what's real from what's not. And then the next couple of the verses, which take it down to earth in a consoling way. Patiently, O Prince, bit by bit, let one gradually calm one's mind. On divine inner self, focus inwards, not letting the mind wander round. Time after time, mind will stray, outward by senses drawn away. Time and again, it be withdrawn, focused on inner self alone. Isn't that lovely how this, in a few verses, you go from the one extreme, the exalted yogi, the saint, to the path there, to the encouragement and the understanding how rough the mind is. It's not going to be in one day. You want to be a Beethoven? Start by playing scales and accept that it's long practice. We have lifelong, many lives to do what we can to progress on this path.
Right. Very good. Well, and there's the conundrum again. You know, there's the long path and the short path, right? The way of immediate enlightenment and then the way of step-by-step process. And it's not like one excludes the other. I think we've all had maybe glimpses of this the truth, you know, but then you have to go back into your real world and integrate it. So, the short path is the opening, you know, to the fact that there is this magnificence and who I am in truth. But then I have to go back, you know, in my studies and integrate that understanding into my everyday life. I mean, I remember when I was first on the spiritual path, you know, there's a huge dichotomy between the wonderful breakthroughs, you know, there's only God. And then I was teaching at the time, and then there's children, you know, that I can't stand. And so if I could just be free of the children, I could be in peace and bliss. Well, no, you have to find peace and bliss in the midst of the children, you know. It's a long journey sometimes, but you know, that's the joy of it, isn't it? It's the invitation to integrate what we know at depth, you know, into our everyday lives. And when you could do that, then it's, you know, I think you're really a force for good. Coming back to that word calling or dharma again, that's when we're really being effective in our world. And I wanted to talk about that just briefly. Since you live in Israel.
Yes.
You know, we hear many news stories about, you know, the Middle East conflict, the Palestinians and all that. Yeah. From your perspective, you know, as a Jew living in there and also a spiritual practitioner, you know, and you're on the ground, you're not just talking about it from a distance.
Yes.
You know, tell us about that. What's it like to live in that Bhagavad Gita situation almost, you know, where we've got that dichotomy?
Yeah. Well, look, it's when confronted with a real friction and danger, it makes it a more real and more difficult. Exactly like you said. I find myself at times of greater clarity. I can focus more inwardly and not lose sight of the external battle being a reflection of the inner one, and focusing on motivation, etc. And yet, of course, the frail human lower mind pulls me, at least, back at times of more imminent danger or pain, be it to pain inflicted on Jews or pain inflicted on our brothers and neighbor Arabs, it is terrible. I'm not professing to be an exalted yogi. I think what I can bring to this translation of the Gita is more the testament and the excitement, the passion of and this I can say, that these verses, smooth as pearls, if we let them, when I let them roll around in my mind, they do their thing. They do help bring a greater balance and wisdom, even in chaotic situations outside.
Right, very good. You know, the third part of the Gita kind of becomes a little technical, doesn't it? It gives us insight into some of the philosophical underpinnings of Hinduism in general, and Vedanta. And I'm thinking about, you know, the field and its knower, and yeah, and the three forces of nature, you know, and you know, sattva, rajasic, yeah, and tamasic, whatever,
yeah,
and which we can talk about. Field and its knower, basically, and it's very interesting that term, because, you know, again, quantum physics, you know, talks about the quantum field, right?
Yeah.
And yet there's the knower of the field, which is spirit, and then the field, which is, you know, manifest reality or whatever, the Shakti of it. Yeah. That's very fascinating to me, that.
It is, you know, it is specifically chapter 13, the beginning of chapter 13, of all Gita's chapters, was the one chapter which I didn't connect much, because, like you said, it sounded to me at first to be more technical. I mean, even the name of the chapter, the field and the knower of the field, so, you know, it's like a physics book, and what's the point of it? And then I read a fantastic a commentary on it by a dear teacher, Swami Venkatesananda, one of the disciples of Swami Shivananda, whose translation was the basis for my work, his word-by-word translation. And he goes on in great detail in explaining the rationale of this chapter and why it is so important. In a nutshell, and then it became a favorite chapter for me. I was in a retreat in New Zealand at the time for a couple of months in a very large farm with 6,000 sheep, and a profound change happened there around this chapter for me. Following its edict, it's the direction of identifying the field as the mind and the body and everything around us. And once you do this carefully, the knower of the field is the witness of it. And that still sounds technical until the point in time when you ask yourself, okay, so can I look at the witness the same way that I look for the field? And that, of course, is impossible and leads you to a sort of sink into yourself and realize that you are indeed the knower. So it's a bit too technical for a short talk, but anyway, a fascinating chapter, which I highly, highly recommend. And the other thing that fascinated me about this chapter are these verses after this technical description of the highest echelons of what reality is, etc., which, as we can grasp, is a bit difficult. The witness said, as the prince asked the teacher, so tell me about wisdom. And you'd think that the teacher would say, you know, reality and the atoms, or the unity of the universe and consciousness, etc. And I won't read all of it, but just to give you a flavor, the master says, as for and this is shocking in its simplicity and humility, as for wisdom, I tell you, be humble, be honest, injure no creature, be forbearing to all, be pure, steadfast, serve your teacher devoutly, be unpretentious, cultivate self-control, free from any egoism, senses from constant craving free, aware of human flawed clinging to birth, old age, death, and misery. So this is a paradox again. You know, you're talking about these high quantum-like analysis of reality, and the way to get there, just be humble, be honest, injure no creature. That really melts my heart.
Yeah, very good. And I love what you're doing here. That's the second or third time you've brought that up, that, you know, when we're getting a little highfalutin into philosophy, and there's a lot of high philosophy in the book, there's also the simplicity of, you know, doing the right thing and just being authentic in your life. And that's going to get you there as much as, you know, I tend to be, you know, intellectual and fascinated by the field of its knower, you know, and I see references, you know, links to the Heart Sutra, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and all that. And other people going, oh, what are you talking about? You know, let's get real here. You know, the three qualities I think are very helpful, because they kind of they're emphasized in chapter 14, but they go all through 13 through 18. And basically, the one way you translate them is pure, active, and dull, right? The pure actions, the activity, you know, the energy, and then there's the sort of inert ones and if you know anything about Ayurveda or whatever, you know there's these foods that are associated with pure foods, and then spicy foods, and then leftovers or whatever that coordinate with the three aspects. And in any day, we're all three, aren't we? There could be a pure aspect, you know, a lot of activity and dullness, and so it's not like you're one or the other. I think we're all part of it, but we're talking about balance here, right? We're talking about understanding it clearly.
Yes, these three qualities of nature, they're called gunas in Sanskrit, three currents, if you will, or three tainted glasses of the mind, had me somewhat perplexed for the first years of studying the Gita. Why such emphasis? Out of 18 chapters, 2.5 chapters are dedicated to these three qualities of the mind. Three types of gift, three types of the doer, three types of action, three types. Why this cataloging? And I think it gradually dawns upon you that this is an extremely useful tool. And this is what the Gita is always about. It's about tools for change, not about reading so that you can recite it. Oh, there is the world is like this, or a yogi is like that. That's like reciting recipes for a chocolate cake rather than eating it. And so the Gita is very much about getting to the chocolate itself, and an analysis of these three currents are a wonderful tool for us, because they allow us, speaking of renunciation, to understand these currents flowing through us, and to gradually evolve from, you know, the notion I am angry or I am spiritual to anger is flowing through me right now, or spiritual is flowing through me now, and then materialism is flowing through me, and I am neither spiritual nor materialistic. These are qualities of the mind, and they change as the seasons of nature change. And that's a great tool to really help us dissociate ourselves from what we think we are, from the mind and qualities. We begin by trying to cultivate positive thoughts and the high feelings, and then sort of avoid the rest of it and make believe as though this is all that exists. And this is rather, again, a compassionate view that says, hey, you're the dweller in this body. And, you know, like a tent on a beach with winds flowing through it, sometimes a cold wind, sometimes a warm wind, you let the winds come and go.
Yeah, very beautifully put. And again, to our earlier point, it's the idea that we're not saying, you know, you mustn't do this. It's you observe what you're doing and then make an informed choice about, how, you know, do you want to stay in that or do you want to move to a deeper understanding, of course, is that you're free of all these things, right? That They may be there, but we're not identified with them.
Right. And I don't know if you recall this, but it's quite shocking what the Gita says when the prince says, okay, so I understand about these currents, about these qualities. How does one overcome them? And the Gita's answer is actually quite shocking. Rather than saying, well, you know, you should be more the pure and less the active, it is actually saying one was overcome them. Accepts each state of mind when it is there and does not long for it when it is not there, which is so profound. Can you imagine that? Can we imagine that? I'm feeling saintly. I'm at one with God. And then this passes and in the mind arises materialism or activeness, as it is called. And I should not long for the saintliness that was there. Accept that this is there and that is there, and that is how you become a saint.
Well, because when, you know, if the witness is observing, exactly, you know, the high and the low, then the witness is still there. You know, it doesn't matter what's going on in the observable. You know, look how special I am. I got it all together. Yeah. Well, that's just a play of the mind too, but the witness is always there observing it in stillness. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to tell you about Dr. Bentwich. Can be you can write to him at bentwich@newgita.com. That's BENTWICH at newgita, one word, .com. Or you can visit his website, newgita.com. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Isaac. Next week, we have the always insightful Mark Nebo joining us. He's going to talk about his book on community, More Together Than Alone. His grasp of contemporary issues and his depth of storytelling is sure to be inspiring, as they always are. So listen in next week. But right now, I want to give a heartfelt thank you to Isaac Bentwich. What a delightful show this has been. I'm sure it's inspired people to go and get a copy of your book, which is available in all the usual outlets. And thank you again for tuning in to us all the way from Israel. It's a delight to speak with you.
Thank you. It was such a delightful conversation. Thank you so much.
All right. Many blessings. And thanks for listening, folks. Talk to you next week. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.